This episode of The Business of Watches is brought to you by Panerai. 2025 marks the year of the Luminor, a celebration of bold Italian design, technical innovation, and the legacy of Panerai's most iconic collection. Welcome to The Business of Watches, where horology meets high finance and each tick tells a story of markets, margins, mishaps, and mechanical mastery. I'm your host, Andy Hoffman, Senior Business Editor at Hodinkee. In this series, we dive deep into the global watch industry, a place where centuries-old craftsmanship intersects with billion-dollar valuations, executive brand strategy, and investor speculation. From Swiss valleys to Silicon Valley, we trace the movements shaping this uniquely resilient sector. Just how big is the business of timekeeping? Well, some estimates place the entire watch industry, from ultra-luxury maisons to smartwatches and microbrands, at north of $100 billion globally. But behind that figure is a complex web of legacy, innovation, and ever-shifting consumer tastes and demand. This is the podcast for collectors, analysts, watch buyers and sellers, and anyone who's fascinated by the intersection of wristwear and wealth. Because if time is money, then money is most certainly time. So let's get down to business. So this week on The Business of Watches, we are going to do something a little different. We are going to hear from you, our amazing listeners and supporters, and we're going to try and answer some of your watch industry business-related questions. I'm your host, Andy Hoffman, Senior Business Editor at Hodinkee in Geneva, and today I am joined by a very special guest, James Stacey, the Editor-in-Chief of Hodinkee. James, welcome.
Hey, Andy.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. How are things over there on that side of the pond?
Things are great, man. Happy Halloween. Things are real spooky over here. It's a dark and rainy sort of night. I think it's going to be a bit of some wet trick-or-treating, but I'm looking forward to the chance to go out and enjoy it. It was always a highlight when I was a kid. And let's start the questions off with this. One, is Halloween really as big in Geneva as it is in Canada and the States? And two, what are you going as tonight?
Right. So the answer is no. Mm-hmm. It is not as big a holiday. But in the time that I've been here, about 10 years or so, it has certainly become more of a holiday and more of an event that people celebrate and recognize. For this evening, I will be dressing up as someone who sits on their couch with their partner and has dinner and watches a movie, which is a very good costume.
Or any movie planned or hasn't been picked just yet?
We have not picked the film just yet.
What could I recommend?
Later. Yeah, what would you recommend?
Let's see. William Friedkin's Sorcerer is probably the move for Halloween.
Oh, that's right.
It's a pretty intense film. We could go lighter if you wanted. It is a Friedkin after all.
I'm up for intense.
But it's a good one.
That's great. Well, thank you for that. And I will see if that is available in Switzerland.
Well, fingers crossed.
So we should get down to business because that is why we are here. So what we're going to try and do is answer business-related questions from listeners that you put out the word on Instagram, and we got a whole bunch of great questions. So yeah, why don't I get you to start off with the first question?
Absolutely, yeah. We got a handful of great ones from the Instagram, so always keep an eye out, as I think, you know, it's usually CEO interviews, and those have been going really well. Andy, I'm a huge fan of the show, of course, but we thought we'd mix it up every now and then with a chance for people to ask questions. We have a senior business editor, which is amazing for Hodinkee, and I think there's a lot of interest in this at a general level, and I'm here to kind of facilitate or represent to a certain extent the audience, which of course I do number among. So yeah, let's kick off the first question here, which is from Doc Thrillman, who says, how does the current downtrend in the market affect small or newer horology brands?
Yes. Well, indeed, we will confirm and acknowledge that there is a downtrend in the market. It is very much a different time than the post-pandemic era boom, which was sort of the most unprecedented increase in demand and interest for watches that we've seen. But we're still in a very elevated place for that. And so how does that affect, you know, newer, small, high-end watch brands? So, I mean, I think it's interesting in some ways, a smaller brand that has at least already, you know, gotten notice. You think of someone like Simon Brett, or obviously Rexep Brecheppi, and Acrivia, someone like that who has interest and profile. I mean, these are brands that are making, you know, 50 to 100 watches a year. And so when interest and demand and, you know, the size of demand and the audience that is buying high-end watches shifts and maybe downshifts a bit as people spend their hard-earned money on other things or look for other kind of experiences, for a small brand like these, the change isn't that much. They've got their core audience, their core customer base who are, you know, who can fulfill that demand for 50 to 100 watches a year.
Right.
Even someone like MB&F, you know, 400 watches a year there. I mean, Max has been around 20 years with that brand now, and the audience has grown, the customer base has grown. And so in the absolute boom era in 2022 and 2023, they couldn't keep anything around. The demand was so high.
Right.
But now the production size is such that the audience is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Where we see difficulty is in smaller brands who have, you know, yet to establish a high profile, who have yet to sort of, you know, gain that mainstream interest. And when they're trying to, you know, find that buyer for the 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 or up to 10,000 watches that they make a year, when the market demand turns down, that becomes much more difficult. So we do see that with some of the smaller brands who aren't as well established at this point.
Right. And I think the other thing that at least jumped to my mind when I read this question was with some of these small brands, and you list, you know, brands like Rexep Brecheppi, Bernerand, you know, et cetera, even if there is a downturn, depending on the delta of the downturn, they might have orders that span it. So they may be able to bridge a low point or even a low season or two without that much work. And then with some of these guys, I mean, it's one thing to have the orders or the allocations. It's another thing to have an, you know, a Gmail inbox full of people champing at the bit to pick up one of those allocations if somebody decided they didn't or couldn't afford it at that point in their life. So there is a little bit of an insulation when you have, like you said, that kind of fan base. And if you haven't developed that yet, and then you have to go through a time like this, it could be harder.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, we had Sylvain Benoit on the show a few episodes ago to talk about, you know, the business side and how he's managing that of his business. And indeed, I mean, you know, he's sold out until, you know, a few years down the line. And so when things turn down, it's actually an advantage for a small producer like that because they have better access to the components and parts that, you know, they were fighting to get previously, because obviously this, you know, the smaller player that you are, you're making 50 to 100 watches a year, you're not going to have as much influence or status with the supplier who's maybe selling, you know, similar parts to one of the giant names in the industry who's buying tens of thousands of parts.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Good question, Doc Thillman. That's a solid one to kind of kick off the show. Let's jump into the next one from Clark Maxwell. Shout out, Clark. Do you think Omega's Master Chronometer and iconic lines like the Speedmaster and Seamaster justify the price slash cost in the marketplace? This is an interesting one because it's a little bit closer to the product zone than just the normal, you know, sort of like a business question directly. But I think it's also fascinating because, you know, Omega makes a ton of watches, you know, at least on paper, the second biggest and most prolific watch brand in the world, as they're well known. And they make a lot of different models. But, you know, I think Clark probably has been around. I've definitely recognized the name and that sort of thing from Instagram, has been around for a while. And Omega has really come up market and over the course of the last, I mean, decade. You could probably compress it into less than a decade as they kind of went towards Rolex and opened up a gap in the Swatch system for other brands to kind of fill in.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And indeed, we have to think, you know, we are talking specifically about Omega here, but what we're really talking about is price, right? And what we've seen in the past few years, post pandemic era boom, is that we've seen some brands really take a lot of price. And there's many reasons for that. Obviously, there's inflation has become an issue in the marketplace for the first time, real inflation for the first time in a long time. Also, the Swiss franc and all these watches are deemed Swiss made, and the Swiss franc has continued to strengthen against various currencies. And then just, you know, labor costs, all these costs in general have increased. And so we've seen a lot of brands take a lot of price, and Omega has been one of them. However, I think you're exactly right. You know, when we think about who Omega sees as its competitor in the marketplace is Rolex. And if we think about the equivalent timepieces at Rolex, so we're talking about a Speedmaster, we're talking about a Daytona, and, you know, what does a Speedmaster Professional cost now? I think $8,000, depending on the glass. That's still quite a bit cheaper than a Daytona.
Right.
Of course, availability is a different question, but it's a similar equation with the Seamaster, with the diving watch, and the Submariner. It's still, if you, you know, believe and what, you know, Omega would certainly tell you that the quality of their product is at the same or if not a higher level. And many people say that the coaxial movements are a superior movement to what some other competitors are doing. So yeah, they're getting closer in price. But I think the issue that people have is that we've seen price move quite quickly in a short period of time. And many people could say, well, I can remember when a Speedmaster was $5,000.
Sure.
And it's not anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's just the new reality.
Yeah, and I also think over that span of time, not only did the price go up, but they invested a lot in movement architecture. We saw them go from coaxial modified, you know, 2500 base movements to in-house coaxial movements, hand-wound movements that are using the master chronometer certification, then the adoption of Metas. And this sort of thing. And I think, you know, we've seen them kind of progressively up the ante on the quality and technical attributes of the movements. And, you know, I don't want to sound glib about it, but they don't seem to be having a tough time selling watches. And I see in many ways Seamasters and Speedmasters on both sides of what I would call the, you know, market divide, both on enthusiasts and on general buyers. People who might only know James Bond, people who might only have wanted to spend some money at the, you know, at the duty free. And that was available, and maybe the Rolex that was also on their list certainly wasn't.
Yep.
So I think in many ways, yeah, the price has gone up, but you have to credit them. I think even their most in-demand watch that I can remember in the recent history, the White Dial Speedy, even that one, while maybe difficult to get, was not one where you were waiting years, I don't believe, certainly not, in the feedback that I've been given, anecdotally, of course. But these are watches that are gettable if you're patient, and certainly I think it's nice that a brand of that profile and that's making a watch at that caliber. And look, I owned 1120 Seamasters. The modern stuff is better on every single measure. I might prefer a sword hand to a skeleton hand, that's just me. But the new stuff, the new Speedmasters, the new Seamasters are a higher quality watch than I think what they were making when they were more in the Tudor, Tudor Plus price category. And certainly, I think the Planet Ocean was the thing that really kicked that off, this sort of next generation of their manufacturing.
Right.
And I think we've seen that now kind of reflect into a lot of different watches. And then you have the stuff that stacks on top of it, like, you know, they just released the latest generation of the Dark Side of the Moon models, where they're taking the Speedmaster idea and really making it a truly modern, you know, ceramic and the rest of it. So yeah, I don't think the pricing feels out of line for 2025, but I can understand if you came to the brand in say 2008, 2010,
yeah,
to be able to see the scope of that difference could feel jarring, or even if you were more at home with the brand in the 1120 era, it might be a little bit more difficult to figure out an 8500 or something like that now.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, I think you bring up a good point in that, you know, although there are many, many models, and some would say too many SKUs for some of those models for Omega, we do see innovation, we do see iterations, we do see new technology and newness and innovation there. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, we had George Kern from Breitling on the podcast a few episodes ago, and, you know, he talked about price, and he said, you can continue to raise price, but you have to offer the consumer something new and something, you know, value for that price increase. And so I think, yeah, Omega is certainly doing that. And, but yeah, you know, people complain about prices.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Should we jump in the next question, which I can find us here?
Yeah, let's do it.
Uncoverist has a somewhat related question, and they say, what is the best perpetual calendar watch under $20,000? Now, I'm not really a perpetual calendar watch kind of guy, and I'm not sure that that's your style of watch either, James. But I mean, you know, this is the sort of pinnacle of complications for many in the watch world. And Uncoverist is asking, what's the best one under $20,000? So, I mean, you know, in the last episode, we just had on the CEO of Frédéric Constant, the Swiss-based brand, originally of sort of Dutch origin. And, you know, one of the sort of pillars of their high horology manufacturer aspect of their business is a perpetual calendar, which is under $10,000. And he talked about how difficult that is to achieve. And especially these days, a stronger Swiss franc, higher labor costs, et cetera, et cetera. But it is a extremely important sort of price level and number that they want to keep that model priced under. It's just a psychological number there, and that's what they do. So they work hard, and they basically, as the costs increase, they basically take less margin because they think it's very important for the brand to do so. So Frédéric Constant is certainly, when it comes to price, is one of those brands that can offer you some value across various models for a perpetual calendar well under 20,000.
Yeah, I would agree. I think Frédéric Constant is the one that leaps to mind. You know, I believe Furlan Mari is in the process of figuring out a number in a serially produced, you know, option for a QP that we've seen from them in the past. The one that leaps to my mind isn't 20 anymore, but when it came out, I was at the launch in Vegas many years ago. I think it was actually the first time I hung out with Ben, was the JLC Master Ultra Thin.
Nice.
It was just under 20, but we're talking like 2014, 2015. So you'd have to adjust for that. This the steel model, black dial, I think an incredible watch. If you're going to spend $20,000 on a watch, I think JLC is a nice way to do it, especially in something kind of traditional and at the same time like watchmaker-y, which is of course the JLC's kind of raison d'etre. And yeah, I think it's a great watch. I'm assuming it's going to be a little bit more than that now, brand new. You know, we're recording this over Zoom, so I can't turn on the VPN that allows me to see USD pricing.
Right.
It'll disrupt our phone call, but I'm seeing like 40,000 Canadian, so that's probably in the 28 to 30 range for something like that. Who knows? I mean, that's going to give you the range for that anyways. Yeah, I think if I was in the market, and I would love to be a perpetual calendar guy, the reason I'm not is because most of them are more than $20,000, right? I do think it's a fascinating complication and one of my favorite to kind of dig into the history of.
Sure.
I do think there's some pretty compelling options in the secondhand world as well. The JLC would be an option. Baume & Mercier made a QP Clifton, which I think was in the mid-20s, depending on case material. Mont Blanc also had a model for theirs in the Heritage line. I don't know the real world pricing for that, but it would be worth checking because I think it's kind of a nice looking watch. It's in the same aesthetic space as the JLC. So yeah, I think there's some options out there. You don't have to be, you know, pinned down by the Vacherons and the Pateks and that sort of thing. But it's definitely, it remains a flagship for even when you hit a price point like Frédéric Constant can, it's still their flagship because of the complexity.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it remains the sort of center of the complication world for many. And indeed, I think one, when we're talking about secondary market options, I mean, IWC.
Oh, yeah. The GST series. If you can do 43, 44, 45 millimeters, there's a lot of options there. I like the big pilots. They're very big, but some of them are quite colorful and cool. But yeah, the stuff from the GST line, they made some neat models in there as well.
Yeah. But on the more dressy side, you know, vintage Da Vinci models, you can find those in, I think, in precious metals, perpetual calendar, certainly under 20,000, I think. So there's some good value there.
For sure. Yeah. Cool stuff. Good question. Yeah, QPs are fun, but they are seldom inexpensive.
Absolutely.
We're proud to have Panerai supporting the business of watches. For this episode, we're spotlighting the new PAM01574, a Luminor GMT Power Reserve in a sleek 44mm black ceramic case. It features a sandwich dial, dual-time functionality, a 3-day power reserve, and Panerai's new click-release strap system for easy swaps. This reference represents Panerai's forward-thinking approach to its Luminor collection, combining heritage, high-tech materials, and bold design. And it's just the beginning. Expect more exciting Luminor launches throughout 2025, alongside the Depths of Time, a historical showcase taking place this October at Casa Panerai Madison in New York City, and this November at Panerai Miami Design District Boutique. Experience never-before-seen archival pieces and exciting novelties up close. Learn more at Panerai.com or check the show notes. Thanks again to Panerai for their support of the business of watches. And now back to our special Q&A episode of the business of watches with Hodinkee Editor-in-Chief James Stacey.
All right, next up we've got a question from Time the Destroyer. Good tag there for Instagram. He says, Swiss watch exports rose 15% to the UK in September. What do you think is behind that relatively huge spike?
So this is a great question, and it's quite interesting and strange. I mean, so, you know, this year, you know, starting back in 2020 was 2020, and obviously the market was completely disrupted. Beginning in 2021, you know, Swiss watch exports have been hitting record levels by value year after year up until last year when they declined slightly for the first time since then. This year has been just an absolute roller coaster. And if you're trying to track the Swiss watch export statistics from month to month, and that's all because of tariffs. So in, you know, we're coming along in the year that we thought was going to be perhaps slightly better, or, you know, certainly at the same levels as 2024. And then the tariff situation happened in the United States. So we saw a massive surge in Swiss watch exports to the US beginning in March and April as manufacturers tried to get product to retailers to avoid, at that time, I think it was a 31% tariff, and then it kicked in to be a 10% tariff for a while, and things kind of normalized a bit. And then when we had the latest announcement of tariffs, and so yes, it's October 31st, it's Halloween right now, and so as of today, it's a 39% tariff on Swiss goods imported into the United States. And so in August this year, before those tariffs kicked in, we saw a massive spike in Swiss watch exports to the US. And so now in September, we saw a massive drop in Swiss watch exports to the United States. And so one of the strange standouts, though, of that report for September was this big jump in exports to the UK. So the UK and the US are very different watch markets. Obviously, the UK is an extremely mature market, very well educated, quite well in terms of watch knowledge, and certainly well established, lots of retail locations, et cetera. And so that market has been sort of flat or not particularly strong for the past little while. And so I think maybe what's happening there is that, you know, the US market is obviously pretty well supplied after we've seen these various surges in exports to the US. And so I think that retailers, whether they be, you know, Boucherer, Tourneau, or Watches of Switzerland, which is the parent company of Hodinkee, you know, when they're taking delivery of watches, perhaps watches that were destined originally for the United States are maybe now going to the UK. And obviously, you know, retailers and brands are trying to be a little more diverse and not as concentrated in the US as they have been. The US is still the biggest single country market for Swiss watch exports, but obviously it's a market that's in flux and under pressure because of those price changes. So that may be one of the reasons. But we also saw mainland China and Hong Kong have a substantial jump in September. So, and that gives people some hope that, maybe the Chinese market is finally starting to recover a bit, because it's been very weak for the past 18 months, 2 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't think I can put it better than that. I think that's a pretty succinct answer to what's an interesting question and sort of an evolving scenario that's based more in what's happening outside of the UK than necessarily what's happening inside, which is fascinating. So a good question, for sure.
Obviously the manufacturer, obviously the Swiss manufacturers are here, but it's a global market, and where the watches are exported to shifts over time as certain markets become more important, for sure. But let me ask the next question, which is from Lori D. And they ask, with the economy worsening post-COVID, do you see it hitting the big groups like Swatch, Richemont, or LVMH, or the indies? So, when things turn down economically, who is more vulnerable and who gets hit harder? Is it the big groups or is it the indies? Do you want to take this one, James? What do you think?
I mean, I can definitely kick it off. I think this would be, one to rely on the kind of data that you track quite carefully. But I think the last few years have been tough for a lot of the big groups, especially trying to decide what to do with the resources and spoils that they used to appreciate out of China, which in many ways have diminished, or in some brands, the doors almost closed entirely. And probably the speed at which it happens is difficult for an industry as slow as Swiss watches, but catching up with the fact that America became kind of the number one market. And then at the same time, we have this trigger of the tariff on the product. So it's obviously a complex scenario. I'm not an economist, but I think I would be, if I had to pick a chessboard to be playing, I would prefer to be, an independent with flexibility and a waiting customer base than a large scale, conglomerate that has to deal with not only distribution, but also now warehousing, theoretically, watches around parts of the world to try and preempt what could happen, in the news cycle of a given day.
Yeah.
Is that off base? Am I only seeing one slice of it?
No, I think that's exactly right. And indeed, we obviously Swatch, Richemont, LVMH, the big groups, I mean, these are all publicly traded companies. So we can, and they break out the performance of their watch brands to various degrees in terms of the amount of information that we can take from it. But, we don't know exactly which Swatch brands, at least from what they disclose, are doing better than others. But we do know, obviously, that revenue and profit have been down quite sharply. We've seen the same with Richemont, where it's broken out in terms of their specialist watchmakers group. And quite interestingly with Richemont, which always makes it, if you're looking at their financial results, and you're looking in the specialist watchmakers section for clues about how the watchmakers are doing, you have to bear in mind that they do not include Cartier and Cartier watches, because Cartier is in the jewelry section of those financial results. And if you look at the results, the jewelry division has been performing quite strongly and continues to do quite well. And as we know, though, Cartier is basically the second biggest Swiss watch brand. And so where we see those strong results, it's in that section of Richemont. LVMH is the same thing in that their major watch brands, Tag Heuer, Zenith, and Hublot, are bulked in with the jewelry side, which would include Tiffany and Bulgari, those assets. So it's hard to get a sense specifically of how watches are doing, but obviously it's been a tough go for them. And we see those declines, single digit declines generally over the past couple of years in terms of sales, but still that is difficult after such a sustained period of growth and interest in watches. But on the indie side, the question is, what are we calling independence? If we're talking about Patek Philippe and Audemars Piguet and Rolex, they're generally doing just fine. All of these brands that have such high demand for, you know, most of their models, that may decline a bit in that when someone gets the call, they might defer and not take that watch. But there's, all, you know, generally someone next on the list who's more than willing and able. And as you say, they're still working through all of those waiting lists, you know, for many models that have existed for months, if not years. So they're generally doing fine. I mean, you know, who feels it in an economic downturn generally is, you know, those watch brands and watch products that are true, you know, discretionary purchases by discretionary, more discretionary consumers than others, who are thinking, should I spend, you know, $3,000 here on this watch, or should I go on holiday with the family right. and do this? And so, yeah, you know, and they just think differently about buying a watch these days when there is economic pressures. As we always say, nobody needs a watch. It is a true discretionary purchase, and it, you know, can vary very much in terms of economic sentiment.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those weird things where, you know, we're talking about an economy worsening, not necessarily a full-on meltdown of an economy or a marked recession, you know, a widespread marked recession across categories. I think that what we remember from the previous larger meltdown/recessions is there is an upper category of the market that's entirely insulated from it.
Yep.
Some of these brands did better over the 2008 and the housing crisis changes. And, you know, I think it's probably harder for the brands where their audience has some money to spend on a watch, but it's not free money. It's money that they take from somewhere else in their life. Like you said, like you might be picking between an upgrade to the house or a vacation with the family or this, or maybe putting it into an investment portfolio with the hopes of returning to this question in 18 months with a different outcome. I think there's a, you know, there's a category that will become non-buyers. There's a category that will become more patient. And then there's a category that's like probably largely unaffected by kind of in terms of their casual spending, which it, look, to be clear, like we're talking casual spending on stuff like Pateks and APs or, you know, in other categories, Ferraris and Porsches and that sort of thing. It's not the average buyer. But when you're talking about the brands where their average price point is in that category, they have kind of they're playing their own game to a certain part.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's just a different economic equation. And if you're spending $20,000, $30,000 on a watch, you have different economic realities. And absolutely.
Good question, Laurie D. Thanks so much for that one. Next up, we've got one from TwoBanks123, who says, things to consider. It's not really a question, more of a statement, but I'll phrase it as a question. What are the things I should consider when buying my first nice watch? So this is a fun one, and there's a bunch of different angles to go at it. But Andy, I'd love to see sort of the way that you would approach this advice to somebody. Maybe let's make the assumption they're on my Instagram or Hodinkee's Instagram or yours, so they know watches. They probably have a couple. Maybe they want to make that leap to the one that maybe they really feel will scratch the itch, spend a little bit more money than they're used to.
Yeah.
What's sort of the mental math to get there?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and I think if we think about it in terms of business terms or economic terms, I mean, first of all, I think if there's one thing that we've learned over the past few years, we shouldn't think of watches as an investment, right?
Yep.
As a financial investment. Although many people seem to do just that in the pandemic era, and some people did quite well doing that. But of course, everything comes back to reality, and that's where we are now. And so thinking of watches as an alternative investment of some kind, that's not the way to do it. However, one can and should be aware of, you know, metrics like value retention or secondary market price performance of watches and brands. And so obviously there are some brands and watch models that hold their value better than others. And, you know, Rolex, Patek Philippe, Audemars Piguet, these well-established, you know, high-end brands that we all know generally do tend to hold their value better than some other marks. At the same time, it all depends on the model. And as we say, it's not about looking at watches as an investment. It's an investment in yourself and what makes you feel good and what you like and what kind of message you want to send with what's on your wrist. But Also, when we start talking about a nice watch, you know, every 5 to however many years, I think Rolex now says 10 years, but, you know, you're going to have to get a proper mechanical watch serviced. That costs money. Mm-hmm. That's something to factor in. But I'd be interested from you, James, and as someone who's covered, you know, this industry for so long, and sort of what categories or sort of, you know, brands or marks where you used to really find, you know, good value for money in terms of a nice first watch. And has that changed much, do you think, in recent years? And you know, where is that better place to start, do you think, now?
Like, I think at where we exist right now, there are fewer bad watches than there ever have been, but there's also more choice than ever. But just the quality of manufacturing has kind of caught up with kind of what was promised in, say, 2008, 2010, somewhere around there. And I believe that, you know, Two Banks doesn't offer a price range or a category. Are we talking premium? Are we talking ultra premium? Are we talking luxury? Are we talking more of an entry level idea of a nice watch? Because, like, I don't think Tissot's made a better watch than they make now.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I would argue the same for Longines. Are making a fantastic line of watches. Tudor's firing on all cylinders. These are all things we know. I don't think Zinn has ever been stronger from a manufacturing and interest standpoint. They just keep broadening their catalog. It used to be quite narrow. You used to have to fall into one of their categories. And now it feels like you can kind of pick, like, find something that kind of suits just about any wrist. And those are all, you know, I'm listing watches that might be $1,000 to $5,000 or $6,000. If you're spending more than that, I think we have to talk about and then negate Rolex to a certain extent. If you can get the Rolex that you want, that's probably the safest purchase. The quality level is exceptionally high. The quality control is exceptionally high. The manufacturing quality is exceptionally high, but they're very difficult to buy. If you're lucky enough to be able to get a, I don't know, a whatever it is you're really wanting, a 36 millimeter Explorer, and not wait forever or be told, you know, check back in X number of times over the next number of years, sure, fine. You'll probably do best there, and you'll have some safety where if this watch doesn't do it for you, you can sell it, right? Pretty much every other brand, you'll have some sort of a fall off, some sort of a depreciation scale for the model. Not always. I mean, you might get lucky. It might hold its value. I'd say that anytime if you're looking at a watch that's modern and is largely available, at least understand what it costs on the secondary market. So if you want to go buy a new Speedmaster, you want to go buy a new Black Bay 54, you want to go buy a new Zinn or something like that, double check what they're selling for on, you know, Watch Recon. You can at least get a number in your mind for what people are listing them for, eBay, that sort of thing. And I think that way you can start to see, like, oh, okay, like, this is a bit of a safer bet or that. Besides the monetary element, like, you should have a budget and do your best to stick to it and find a watch that suits the amount of money that you'd like to spend. Or come at it from the other direction and have a specific watch in mind and then figure out how to make that part of your budget. I mean, people will do both of these things at the same time, which is why it's difficult to say things to consider when buying your first nice watch is, like, do you want to stick to a budget or do you want a very specific watch? I would say because the watch part of this question is open-ended, we'd focus on the budget side. I think, you know, you want to consider how the watch matches your own personal style, your personal concepts of like what you value. You know, for me, I will remain a big fan of 5-digit Rolexes. I'm wearing my 16570 now because I loved that era of Rolex that felt modern but was still deeply tied to the sort of explorer professional lifestyle or you know, dream of the lifestyle.
Yeah.
Before they became kind of more of a purely luxury product. And I mean, again, it's not a question of quality but of positioning. And so you have to understand what you might like, what you might not like. If you love a pilot's watch, it's really hard to tell you to not look at something from IWC because you get a classic style, you get an incredible quality, great movements, good serviceability, an international network for the watch, that sort of thing. But at the same time, it really comes down to, like, what do you want? What do you have to spend? What do you like? So I think the important things is definitely considering, you know, do you really need a chronograph, or in 5 or 6 years are you going to be upset when it's $1,500 to service it? And then it's $1,500 to service it 8 years later or whatever. So figure out what your needs are. Don't buy complications you don't need or that you won't use, right? And I would say go from there. I mean, it's a nebulous question without a budget or a category or that sort of thing. So it's hard to kind of pin down maybe what Two Banks was looking for. But yeah, I think, you know, make sure that you the part of this process that's free is the research and the walking into a mall and or a retailer or seeing a watch or going online and finding a form for that watch and learning about it. All of that is just your time. Once you've bought the watch, you know, I hope you want to wear it and really like it. But the more you invest in the pre-purchase time, I think the more you'll enjoy that watch and get the right one.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And yeah, I mean, the research and coming to that decision for your first nice watch is, you know, really such a part of the joy of all that indeed. But one thing that you brought up that I thought was really important was, you know, understanding, obviously, you know, when we're talking about Rolex or well-known models, they're all, you know, an Omega Seamaster or something, there'll always be liquidity. There'll always be some kind of demand. You know, price is another issue and value retention is another issue. But indeed, liquidity, the ability to sell that watch if you ever want to and to move on to something else.
If that matters, yeah.
If that matters, that's something to consider as well.
For sure.
So, yeah, indeed. Thank you, Two Banks, for that question. Quite interesting. There's a lot to consider on that for sure. Mm-hmm. So I think we've run out of time. So we want to say thank you to James Stacey, the editor-in-chief of Hodinkee, for joining us. That was really fun, James. Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been an absolute treat. Love to take questions.
Excellent. And so stay tuned for the next episode of Business of Watches, which should drop in about 2 weeks. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. And that's the Business of Watches for this episode. We hope you enjoyed. Please head on over to hodinkee.com, where you can join the discussion and leave any comments or questions about this episode or the business of watches in general. Who knows? We might even answer your question on a future episode. Thanks for listening, and see you next time. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh episode of The Business of Watches. Until then, I'm Andy Hoffman, and I'll see you on hodinkee.com.